I'm Marty Moscoen. Welcome to Radio Times. First, a big shout out and thank you to the Philadelphia Eagles for that exciting season and performance last night. You made us all proud winning the Super Bowl. Go to our Facebook page to join this celebration. Now on to another big story. The much-anticipated and much-hyped memo declassified by President Trump was released by House Republicans on Friday. It claims that FBI officials misled the FISA court so it could surveil Carter Page, a foreign policy advisor to the Trump campaign. President Trump said the memo totally vindicates him, even as the, quote, witch hunt goes on and on, referring to the Mueller investigation into collusion and obstruction of justice. The FBI opposed the memo's release, as did Democrats on the Intelligence Committee, with Adam Schiff saying the memo was designed to injure and discredit the work of the special counsel. The Democrats have written their own memo to counter the Republicans. We asked Byron Tao to walk us through the memo and what it means, and he covers Congress and politics for the Wall Street Journal. Byron, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Thanks for having me, and congratulations to the Eagles.
Yes, yes, yes. We're all very excited here in Philadelphia and certainly across the country as well. Byron, let me ask you, after this big buildup about the release of the memo, it seems over the weekend a number of Republicans have distanced themselves from this memo. What is the punch, you think, as of this morning?
Well, you're right. A couple of Republicans, including Republican Representative Trey Gowdy on the Sunday shows, have said, look, this is not about the Mueller investigation. It's about oversight of the Department of Justice that Congress has to conduct. Even James Comey, the Republican-appointed FBI director, called it a bit of a dud. But generally speaking, the partisan fight over this memo goes on, with many of its Republican authors saying it exposes wrongdoing at the highest levels of the Department of Justice and the FBI, and many Democrats saying that it's something of a dud, something of a partisan document designed to discredit the ongoing Russia investigation.
I want to pick up on that, but let me play Trey Gowdy. He was on Face the Nation yesterday discussing the memo with host Margaret Brennan.
I actually don't think it has any impact on the Russia probe for this reason.
The memo has no impact on the Russia probe.
Not to me it doesn't, and I was pretty integrally involved in the drafting of it.
In fact, Byron, Nunes asked Trey Gowdy to look at the documents to help write this memo, correct?
That's right. So only a couple of very senior members of Congress and some very senior staff members on the House Intelligence Committee have actually seen the underlying documents. So these are the FISA warrant applications and some other material that are sitting over at the FBI and the Department of Justice. And Trey Gowdy was one of those people, as was Democrat Adam Schiff, the top Democrat on the Intelligence Committee. So many of the Republicans and the Democrats who are talking about this memo in public have actually not seen the underlying source documents. So we're essentially looking at a filtered view of what are some very, very classified documents that only a handful of people have actually seen. Trey Gowdy is one of those people.
Well, and Nunes has not seen it. Is that correct?
That's right. Devin Nunes has reportedly not seen these documents, though his top staffer on the House Intelligence Committee has, and that staffer was the one that drafted the memo. So, you know, his staff has made the argument that he's fully informed and in the loop on this. But it's true, he has not seen the underlying documents.
Has the president seen the underlying documents?
That's a good question. The president has the right to access this material. It's in his administration. He has the highest security clearance. In fact, he could declassify it at will. It's unclear if he's actually seen the documents, but he could.
Now, it seems that the heart of the Republican argument is that the FBI did not tell the FISA court that their request to surveil Carter Page did not include information that the Steele dossier was funded by the Democratic National Committee and Hillary Clinton. Is that the heart of their argument, Byron?
That's essentially the question that Congress is probing with this memo. How did a Trump campaign advisor end up being surveilled? And was it on the basis of some material that was paid for by the Trump campaign's political opponents? Now, that, to me, strikes me as a legitimate question to ask. But again, a lot of these documents are so highly classified, no one in the public domain has seen the underlying source material, it's hard to evaluate exactly what occurred. There is some dispute about what the FBI and the Department of Justice told the FISA court. For example, we have some sources indicating to us that the FISA court was told that some of this material, that Christopher Steele was being paid by an entity with some sort of political motivations. And typically in legal filings, when you see a court filing of any kind, usually the person, people and organizations unrelated to that filing tend to have their names redacted. So often if you read a legal filing, it'll say person A or company A or company B. So it sounds like this is what happened in the case of the FISA warrant.
But what's interesting is it was renewed, what, three times? My understanding, and I think we're all learning about what it takes to get a FISA warrant, is that it takes a lot of steps. There are a lot of people involved. And I don't know if there were four separate FISA judges involved, but it seems that it had to go through a lot of approval in order to get approved in the end.
That's right. This warrant was renewed at least two times under President Trump's administration by appointees that he put into place. So his senior level Justice Department officials approved and signed off on the renewal applications, and probably four separate judges, if our sources are correct, signed off on the renewals. And the standard for signing off on a renewal of an ongoing FISA is that it's producing ongoing intelligence. And the standard for getting a FISA warrant is that you must have probable cause to believe that the person under surveillance is acting as an agent of a foreign power. And if the math is right, if there were no gaps in the surveillance, if it started in late 2016, that means Carter Page was actually under surveillance as recently as October of last year. So all this indicates that there was at least some suspicion, ongoing suspicion, that was shared or approved by a federal judge that this person, Carter Page, was acting as an agent of a foreign government, in this case, Russia.
And we've also learned that the FBI had been interested in Carter Page going back to 2013 because of some contacts, some conversations that he had with Russian spies.
That's right. Carter Page actually lived in Moscow in the mid-2000s. He worked for Merrill Lynch. He was a banker. He's become an academic. And in 2013, he was living in New York when he was contacted by two people that the FBI later identified as Russian intelligence operatives who basically essentially made a pass at recruiting him. And all this appears in a court document that was filed in 2015. He later admitted that he was one of the people. As I mentioned, people's names, if they're unrelated in a case, tend to be obscured. So we didn't know this at the time, but he eventually did admit that he was one of the people in this court document and that he was one of the people that Russian agents were trying to recruit as a spy. And so he's been on the FBI's radar, and he's been on Russian intelligence's radar as a potential asset for a couple of years now.
And Time Magazine reported over the weekend that Carter Page said in a document that he had been an advisor to the Kremlin.
That's right. And in addition to that, he traveled to Moscow during the height of the 2016 campaign and met with a fairly high-level Russian official on the sidelines of an academic conference and later wrote to Trump campaign advisors that he had very extensive and positive contacts with the Russian government. And so this is a person who has repeatedly bragged about his ties to high-level operatives. Now, the question is whether he was bragging or whether these are real. I mean, I don't know that anyone knows the answer to that, but there's certainly enough smoke here that the FBI was right to be concerned in some ways about the information they were getting and the history of Russian involvement and Russian intelligence involvement with this person.
Let me get Anne-Marie from Devon, Pennsylvania, to join us on Radio Times. Hi, Anne-Marie. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Yes, hi. I'm wondering why your guest isn't mentioning that the dossier was originally funded by the Free Beacon, which is a conservative Republican website,
right?
Funded by billionaire Paul Singer. They're the ones who originally hired Fusion GPS to unearth damaging information about several Republican presidential candidates. It was only after the Free Beacon told Fusion GPS to stop when Trump was clinching the nomination that the Democrats then picked it up.
No, that's absolutely correct, Anne-Marie. I appreciate you calling into Radio Times. Byron, you want to add to that?
So it's a bit complicated. That all of that is essentially true, that Fusion GPS, a research firm founded by a number of former Wall Street Journal reporters, was originally hired by a conservative publication founded by a sort of anti-Trump billionaire named Paul Singer. But the Steele phase of the project, so Christopher Steele comes in around the summer of 2016 and begins compiling information as part of his research, as part of Fusion's research, most of that was funded by the Democrats and Hillary at that time. So it's true the overall anti-Trump research project began as a Republican project, but the Steele part was funded by the Democrats in that period.
Byron, looking at this dossier, I'm getting my dossiers and my memos confused here, but looking at this memo, and again, I was looking for that quote-unquote smoking gun, but it seems to say that the investigation into Russian contacts with the Trump campaign was not prompted by the Steele dossier, but by something that Papadopoulos said. And he also was identified by the Trump campaign as being an advisor, foreign policy advisor, to candidate Trump.
That's right. It essentially confirms that in July of 2016, the FBI opened an investigation into possible Russian collusion with the Trump campaign based on this contact that George Papadopoulos, who is another foreign policy advisor to the Trump campaign, had in London with a professor and some other outreach that happened around him. So that was the origin of this investigation, not what Christopher Steele was digging up with his sources in Eastern Europe and in Russia. So that's an interesting little tidbit that they included at the end of this, and certainly is a big piece of this ongoing mystery about how this investigation got opened and what are the origins of it.
Now, Adam Schiff, as I understand it, wants to release, well, he's clearly made it clear he does want to release the report from the Democrats. Is there going to be something or a vote today on that, do you know, Byron?
That's right. So the Democrats have written their own rebuttal memo. It's a little bit longer. It purports to explain in greater detail and with greater context the circumstances around the warrant for Carter Page. And there is going to be a business meeting of the House Intelligence Committee today where they are expected behind closed doors to take up a resolution to release that. A lot of Republicans have said they're in favor with it, and it is traditional in congressional investigations to allow dissenting views from the opposite party. So we do expect it will pass, but then the matter goes to President Trump, who gets to decide whether to raise an objection about release. So this could be complicated.
Do we know what the time frame would be for that?
Yeah, so again, the president would have 5 days to object. So that would, if the vote was tonight, that would take him through Saturday. And if he does object, then the Democrats can appeal the decision to the full House of Representatives, and they will ultimately decide the matter.
Byron Tao, thank you for joining us today in Radio Times.
Thanks for having me.
You're very welcome. He covers Congress and politics for The Wall Street Journal. And we have several guests who are waiting in the wings to join us after this very short break, talking more about the memo. We'll be right back. I'm Marty Moscoen, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia, home to the 2018 Super Bowl champions. Well, after several weeks of calls to release the memo, it was done on Friday. It's the work of Republicans on the House Intelligence Committee, alleging that the FBI and Justice Department abused their authority and misled the FISA court when it got the okay to surveil Carter Page. He was a Trump foreign policy advisor who had been on the FBI's radar since 2013 because of his contacts with Russians. President Trump tweeted on Saturday that the memo vindicates him, no collusion, no obstruction, calling the Mueller investigation an American disgrace. Former FBI Director James Comey tweeted after the memo was released, "That's it," calling it dishonest and a misleading memo. Here to talk about all of this is Quinta Jurassic, and she's Deputy Managing Editor at Lawfare, joining us from the Brookings Institution. And Quinta, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Glad to be here.
And with us here in our Philadelphia studios is Claire Finkelstein, and she's the Algernon Biddle Professor of Law, Professor of Philosophy, and Director of the Center for Ethics and the Rule of Law at the University of Pennsylvania Law School. Claire, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Thanks for having me, Marty.
You're very welcome. And to our listeners, lines open at 1-888-477-9499 to join our conversation. Quint, if I could begin with you, and I want to just speak more broadly, and then we'll break down this memo and what it means into its component parts. But what was your overall reaction once the memo was actually released?
I would echo James Comey in saying that's it. There was sort of over 2 weeks of buildup in this document. It started with this hashtag release the memo that sort of went viral on Twitter a few weeks ago. And since then, the anticipation had really been building over what was in it, whether the committee would release it, whether they would release the Democratic rebuttal memo. And so we at Lawfare were sort of on pins and needles waiting for this document to drop. And when it finally appeared, I would say, I mean, there's really just nothing there.
Well, and the subject, Claire says, Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act abuses at the Department of Justice and Federal Bureau of Investigation. That's a big claim.
Well, there's some irony here, in fact, because the ACLU has been concerned about the potentially biased nature of the information that FISA court judges receive. But this is a longstanding worry, and it's a worry on both the right and the left. It has nothing to do with Democratic versus Republican pressure. It has to do with the ACLU's concern about the degree of power that the federal government has to investigate private citizens. So there's an irony here in the Republicans joining forces with the ACLU.
Well, it seems kind of upside down and topsy-turvy,
doesn't it?
It
certainly does, but very fitting for our through-the-looking-glass politics these days.
Well, Quinta, let me go back to you, and Claire, I want to hear from you as well. What does this memo then get wrong? And obviously it's saying that there were abuses at the Department of Justice and the FBI when it asked the court to give it the authority to surveil this guy, Carter Page, who was identified early on in the campaign as an advisor to candidate Trump. Since then, the Trump administration and even campaign has distanced itself as if they never really knew this guy. But what do you see here that's so troublesome?
Well, I would say I don't know if there's anything that it gets wrong that it states outright that's obviously incorrect. What it does do is it's kind of slippery in its language. So it implies, for example, that Deputy FBI Director Andy McCabe told the House Intelligence Committee that the memo was sort of, you know, the sole source of this FISA application to surveil Carter Page. What it actually says, if you read it closely, is that the memo was that the application would not have been submitted without the memo, which is not the same thing as saying the only evidence presented was the evidence contained in the dossier. Likewise, it suggests that the government did not adequately explain to the FISA judge, and this is really the core of the complaint,
right,
that the information provided by Christopher Steele stemmed from Steele, who was being indirectly funded by the DNC and the Hillary Clinton campaign. So that's the memo's really the key complaint. Since then, we've had some reporting from, I think, the New York Times, the Washington Post, and the Wall Street Journal suggesting that the Democratic memo contains information that says that the government did tell the judge that Steele was being funded by a major political party. So the complaint in that case is that they didn't specifically say that Steele was being funded by the Democratic Party. But if you just read the memo, it makes it sound like they didn't include that information at all, whereas in fact it was included. It just the name of the Democratic Party wasn't stated directly.
Well, Claire, is there anything in this that tells us anything about the Mueller investigation?
Well, it's very interesting that Trey Gowdy has now tried to distance the memo, from an attack on the Mueller investigation, and I think that may stem from an awareness on the GOP's part that connecting the two may actually backfire on them. Because if the memo is seen as an attempt to derail Mueller's investigation, it may actually fall into the obstruction of justice on the White House's part if it is also revealed that the White House had a hand in shaping this memo. Now, of course, we don't know whether or not that's the case, but Devin Nunes was notably silent when asked whether or not any of his staff had contact with White House staff on the creation of this memo. And, of course, the fact that the president was willing to declassify it and is not willing to, as far as we know, declassify the Democratic rebuttal.
At least not yet.
Is rather significant. So if I were Robert Mueller, I would now, you know, as of Friday, be launched into yet a further obstruction of justice investigation that might actually rope in the House Intel Committee.
Well, let me follow up on that, because there's the collusion investigation. There's now, of course, the obstruction of justice investigation. As I understand it, collusion is not against the law. Do I have that right or no?
One would have to put that a little bit differently. Collusion itself is not a legal concept. So the legal concepts here are potentially espionage, treason, and a variety of violations, like violations of the Foreign Agent Registration Act, or colluding in violation of being complicit in violations of the Foreign Agent Registration Act, and so on. So one has to break the concept of collusion down into its component legal parts. And then, of course, election laws that prevent any candidate running for office from receiving information and assistance from a foreign government for that purpose. But there's no such thing as collusion per se.
But if we're talking about obstruction of justice, if a president fires someone, and he fired James Comey and seemed to indicate it had something to do with the Russia investigation, how close does that get us to this definition of obstruction of justice?
Well, it gets us very close, because depending on his intent. So the statements that he made about this Russia probe and Trump, right, in which he directly connected his firing of James Comey and the Russia probe, does bring us face to face with the possibility that he fired James Comey in order to try to scuttle the Russia probe. Now, if his actions then continue in that direction, we have a pattern. We have a pattern that establishes an attempt on the part of the president or the White House to eliminate the investigation into his own potential wrongdoing. Mm. And that's where we get into obstruction of justice. And this memo, and apparently there may be more memos coming, would be part of a pattern then of trying to upend the investigation.
Quinta, let me go back to you. And it was reported a couple of weeks ago that back in the summer, the president wanted to fire Mueller, was talked out of it by one of his White House lawyers. But how do you What do you think that tells us?
So my takeaway from that was actually that Trump he barks loudly, but we really don't know how loud his bite was, right? That he's capable of working himself up into a rage to a point where he does things that are extraordinarily aggressive and very dangerous, such as telling his White House counsel, Don McGahn, to fire Mueller. On the other hand, McGahn was able to talk him out of it by threatening to resign.
Right.
And the other piece that's interesting is that he now has a new lawyer, Ty Cobb, who's come in, taken over from the previous lawyer, Mark Kasowitz, who was advising him at the time when he tried to fire Mueller and was a little more sort of brash, loud New York real estate lawyer. Cobb has apparently been telling him for the past few months that, you know, the best way to handle the Mueller investigation is to cooperate. You know, give them what they need, appear cooperative, and that'll work out well for you, because you'll be cleared in the end and it'll turn out that you're innocent. And given that Trump hasn't attempted to get rid of Mueller since then, it would seem to me that Cobb has actually been very successful. Mm. The question is, if Cobb isn't right, if the investigation does get closer to Trump, and if it does seem like Mueller has evidence of real wrongdoing on his part, we may be headed for a big explosion.
You want to add something, Claire? Go ahead.
Quinta, I actually, much as we see matters similarly here, I do disagree with you on one point, which is that I believe that the reason that the president has not fired Robert Mueller is not because Ty Cobb has been successful in convincing him that somehow it's the wrong thing to do, but because he knows that Robert Mueller is most likely, investigating him for obstruction of justice. And he is aware that firing Robert Mueller would then be, you know, exhibit B in the obstruction of justice probe. So the fact that Mueller decided to move strongly into the obstruction of justice domain, in all likelihood, is what is staying the president's hand. But ultimately, it's not clear that that will be successful, just as he was advised by none other than Steve Bannon not to fire James Comey, and yet went ahead and did it anyway.
We have a third guest who's about to join us, but let me just toss something else out. Quinta, I'll put this back to you. On Friday, the president said when he was asked whether he would fire Deputy Director Rod Rosenstein, he said, "You figure that one out." This was to the press. That's not exactly a vote of confidence for Rod Rosenstein.
Indeed, it is not. And I think we should all be really watching what happens to Rosenstein over the next days and weeks, given that Attorney General Sessions has recused himself from the Russia probe against Trump's wishes. Rosenstein is the person who's overseeing Mueller at this point, and there's a lot of danger in that if the president tries to push him out, I think it would be very reasonable to fear that that might be the first step in going after Mueller.
Oh, interesting. Go ahead, Claire.
It does look as though this memo was an attempt to smear Rod Rosenstein in preparation for the president's firing of him. I think it's highly likely that we will see at least an effort on the part of the president to fire him. But once again, what that brings us face to face with is the very real possibility that the White House had a role in crafting this memo. And if it can be demonstrated and proven that the White House did that for the purpose of laying the ground for firing Rod Rosenstein, and the GOP on the House Intel Committee was complicit in that effort, that would create serious legal problems both for the president and potentially for members of that committee.
And that's Claire Finkelstein, professor at the University of Pennsylvania Law School. Also with us is Quinta Jurecic, deputy managing editor at Lawfare. I'm Marty Moscoane, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. Well, FBI Director Christopher Wray told his staffers on Friday that the agency had been through a lot in 9 months. They should keep calm. They should tackle hard. President Trump has attacked the Justice Department and the FBI over the past year, firing Director James Comey and reportedly wanting to fire Robert Mueller this past summer. Joining us now is Clint Watts. He's a Fox Fellow at the Philadelphia-based Foreign Policy Research Institute's program on the Middle East. He's also Senior Fellow at the Center for Cyber and Homeland Security at George Washington University. He's a former U.S. Army infantry officer and an FBI agent. And Clint Watts, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Thanks for having me on.
So is Rod Rosenstein's job on the line here?
I think so. I think it's also something we should always remember with the Trump administration. They're always testing things to see how they play. And they test both audiences to see the reaction, I think, and see how their base rallies around these calls. So I also wonder if it's a warning sign to Rosenstein, which is, you know, sort of submit to my will, do what I want, or, you know, you're in jeopardy of being pushed out. What I do think, though, is the Trump administration has become tone deaf on a lot of these things, meaning they don't really understand the implications long run of their actions. So I wouldn't be surprised if they back away, you know, over the next week, depending on how it goes. And I wouldn't be surprised either if they go ahead and try and fire Rosenstein. And I think it's correct that having him removed puts a strange and difficult twist on the Mueller investigation, because they not only control direction ultimately, but they control resources. So they could actually starve out a Mueller investigation to where it couldn't pursue everything it wanted to pursue.
Of course, that raises questions about what FBI Director Christopher Wray would do under those circumstances. Clint, any way to anticipate that?
No, I think the things I'm looking for this week are really what is the Deputy Attorney General and the FBI Director's response to this memo coming out. Do they sort of say nothing, or do they actually continue to talk to their people and their organizations, like we saw Director Wray do, and say, you know, hold the line, you stay steady, stay true to your job, and that essentially could be we're pushing back. I'll also look for, you know, President Trump to continue tweeting towards Ray or the FBI or the Department of Justice. I'm not sure that they got what they wanted out of this memo, and it's opened a whole new can of worms, as we've seen this morning with Congressman Schiff's memo coming forward. He could put himself in a really bad position. You know, if Congressman Schiff's memo moves up and it goes to the White House and then it's suddenly squashed or redacted in pieces, this could just further add to the conspiracy of obstruction and suppression, you know, the rule of law. So I think they've kind of backed themselves into a strange corner here, and I'm not sure how I heard the comments about Tyga before. I'm not sure how any of this really supports helping the Mueller investigation in the end or clearing himself of the Russia investigation. I think, 6 months from now, 1 year from now, we'll see he's just as embattled with this because he continues to fight in such a public way.
Claire, you want to add something?
Yeah, from the standpoint of the rule of law, we have to remember this memo is only a small piece of the puzzle. Remember that Chairman Nunes has said that he has placed the FBI and the DOJ under investigation. So this is part of a systematic attempt to discredit both the Department of Justice and the FBI, and there will be further attacks. This is not the only one.
Well, and how only because we're up in a break here, and I want to ask a question, but I don't want to have to interrupt you, all of you, for an answer. Let's take that short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation. Talking with Quinta Jurecic, she's deputy managing editor at Lawfare, with Claire Finkelstein, professor at the University of Pennsylvania Law School, and Clint Watt, senior fellow at the Foreign Policy Research Institute here in Philadelphia, former FBI agent, and we are talking about the Nunes memo, the fallout from that memo, and where things go from here. Let's take a very short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia, again home to the Super Bowl-winning Philadelphia Eagles. We're talking about the Nunes memo. It was released on Friday after a heated partisan debate. Republicans claim the memo proves abuses by the FBI. Democrats argue the memo was carefully crafted by Republicans using cherry-picked facts in an effort to discredit the Mueller investigation. Again, our guest, Clint Watts, senior fellow at the Foreign Policy Research Institute, former FBI agent, Claire Finkelstein, professor at the University of Pennsylvania Law School, and Quinta Jurecic, deputy managing editor at Lawfare. I have a sort of an overarching question. Perhaps, Clint, I can put this to you. Certainly we heard from Brennan over the weekend, but I'm wondering, where are the other intelligence agencies to speak out and defend the Justice Department and the FBI in their investigation?
This has always been why the Trump attacks work, is these agencies really can't defend themselves. You know, they can always say, let's say they came out in public and they wanted to refute the president or the Nunes memo, whatever it might be. As soon as they do, they'll say, prove it or show me. This then falls to the intel agencies, who are under a veil of secrecy, to have no real way to do this without declassifying information, revealing sources and methods, harming informants or agents overseas, and this ultimately hurts their mission. So when the president puts these charges to him, he's bullying people that actually can't fight back in public very well until an investigation comes to fruition and everything is put out in the light. And they know that won't happen for some time. So with these weekly or even daily attacks, they can erode democratic institutions that don't really have any viable way of refuting these claims without ultimately harming their ultimate mission, which is to the American people, you know, defending against enemies, foreign and domestic. So it's a real challenge for them. And I'm sure they're trying to think about ways to do this, but also they've never really had to. So this is a unique time for them.
I hear you. Quinta, let me go to you. And I just keep scratching my head that the White House, the administration, is going to the mat for Carter Page.
Yes.
And we have learned more about him, his associations with Russians. He's been on television. I've seen several interviews, rather strange and almost disturbing interviews that he's done on MSNBC. And it seems that of all the people to pick for this potentially constitutional showdown, why Carter Page? Do you have any insight on that?
That is an excellent question, and it's frankly one that I've been scratching my head over as well. I mean, the irony of this is that the Trump campaign actually distanced themselves from Page in the fall of 2016 after news stories came out about his trips to Moscow, his associations with Russians, to the point where he actually stepped down from the campaign in September of 2016 before the election, which is why, of course, one of the sort of flaws of this memo is that the surveillance of Page that it's complaining about began in October 2016 after he'd already left the campaign. So this person who they sort of discarded, they're now holding fast to. And what's particularly interesting is that you've seen some of the Republicans on the House Intelligence Committee kind of distance themselves from the more radical claims about the memo in the wake of its release. Trey Gowdy, for example, right, who had a hand in reading the intelligence that underlies the memo, was on television saying essentially, you know, this doesn't have anything to do with the Mueller investigation. I'm just very concerned about, you know, Carter Page's civil liberties being violated. The other irony is that arguably, Trey Gowdy and the rest of the Republicans in the committee themselves violated Page's privacy by announcing to the world that he was the subject of a FISA warrant. So it's really a confusing situation.
Well, Claire, let's talk about Congress and the role of Congress. And clearly some Democrats have separated themselves from this memo. But what do you see as the responsibility of Congress?
Can I just first give an answer on the Carter Page topic and then come to Congress? I think that the effort to defend Carter Page indicates how important he is to this investigation. And remember that when the president was asked to name who his foreign policy advisors were going to be when he was still on the campaign trail, one of the first, possibly the only name that he mentioned right off the bat was Carter Page. So this is someone who he's been listening to, who he had a much closer relationship with than he owned up to, and who knows a lot about him. And he's becoming aware, of course, of the tendency of people to turn to cooperators. So it may also be a preparation to pardon Carter Page.
So you think he knows perhaps more than he's given credit for?
Oh, I assume that he does.
You assume that he does.
Now, on Congress, the really big mystery here is why so many Republican congressmen are willing to stake their futures on support of this president. I don't for a minute believe that it's because they cared that much about tax reform that they were willing to bring themselves sort of to the brink potentially of illegal activity themselves in order to circle the wagons around this president. And remember that Chairman Nunes was himself the subject of an ethics investigation that was opened in the House, but in this political climate couldn't get anywhere. After the midterms, we may see if, in fact, the balance of power shifts to the Democrats, some of those investigations going forward. They must be aware of the risks that they are running in this regard, and it's a mystery why they are willing to continue down this road.
Well, do you have an answer to that, Quinta?
Yeah, that's a really good question. My guess would be that the answer actually lies in the media landscape. One of the really interesting things that you see about this memo is how it sort of followed a very familiar pattern that we've seen with previous sort of pro-Trump attempts to kick up dust around the Mueller investigation, as with the sort of Uranium One, the texts between FBI employees, one of whom was detailed to the Mueller probe, that basically what happens is that it sort of pops up in more conspiracy-minded corners of the internet, picked up by a sort of fringe right-wing publication, then it gets onto Fox, then it sort of spins up into its own news cycle, and eventually it reaches the president. And by now, we've basically seen that cycle happen. And what that means is that the memo is now its own sort of meme, its own news cycle on Fox, and that these Republican congressmen are in many ways kind of beholden to Fox as a media outlet that many of their constituents watch and think very highly of. So they're a little bit trapped by their own media cycle.
Clint, let me go to you with a slightly different question about Carter Page. One of the quotes from one of the Russians he had contacts with described him as an idiot. I know there's that phrase, useful idiot. Do you think how do you see him? I mean, there are questions about whether he was a spy, is a spy, had aspirations to be a spy. And I said this earlier in the hour, but Time Magazine quoting that he at one point said that he worked for the Kremlin. How do you see him?
Yeah, I think he is one of these business intelligence operatives that have sprung up in the corporate marketplace where you essentially leverage your contacts, your business contacts, across multiple countries in order to build your own business, essentially. You're a value commodity and an interlocutor between, you know, different nations, nations and businesses, businesses and businesses. I think he probably presented himself as different things to different people. And what the Russians, it seems, you know, from that court case you cited, identified when they said idiot probably is in the context of at least a useful idiot, meaning he unwittingly or opportunistically is willing to do things that no other America would possibly do. And they saw him as in the broader category, they call them agents of influence. He is an agent of influence that they can push into the United States or even into a presidential campaign to have influence on the target. I think the other thing to remember is even what the Kremlin does well with their espionage activities, they also identify witting agents who don't need to be coerced, but share the mindset and the ideology of the Kremlin. And they're called, in espionage talk, they're called fellow travelers. Hmm. And so, you know, the Russian intelligence system will identify both useful idiots who unwittingly do it, fellow travelers who wittingly do this. Marine Le Pen in France is an example of that. You know, she's very overt and open about her contacts with Putin and Russia and thinks very similarly policy-wise. And you layer that around your target. I think ultimately what you see with Carter Page is someone the Kremlin thought was not only amenable to their views, but was a direct line into the Trump team. And this is a dream come true if you're running espionage activities, have someone right that close to the target and to the foreign policy shop.
You mentioned Marine Le Pen. Is there anyone in this country that is a fellow traveler, Clint?
I think you could look at members, you know, more prolific members of the alternative right audience in the United States who share Russia's worldview. They're anti-globalists, you know, pro-nationalists. You'll hear this repeated oftentimes. They're anti-immigration. They are very much, you know, strong on the war on terror. They're anti-Islam, and that sort of plays into a broader message. And I think if there's anything we should take away from the 2016 presidential run, is that it shows that Putin's influence operations were able to unify alternative right audiences in Germany, France, UK, United States, even Canada, as a global movement or a global phenomenon. And that's why they've been so effective before and even continue after the election. There are people that share their worldview.
Claire, you want to add something?
In this connection, it's important to note that Arthur Jones, a Holocaust denier and a former leader in the American Nazi Party, looks like he's about to get the Republican nomination for a U.S. congressional seat in Illinois. So we certainly don't see the scaling back of the alt-right influence here.
Quinta, how do you then see Mueller and his investigation proceeding from this point? And obviously there's much we do not know because it's a pretty tight ship. But what do you see?
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of a black box, frankly. I wouldn't want to predict anything going out because I would say what we learned when the Papadopoulos information came out, that Mueller had this witness who'd been cooperating for months and no one had heard the slightest thing. So I'm basically operating on the assumption that Mueller has an enormous amount of information that none of us have any idea about, and therefore it's no business of mine to try to predict what he's going to do next.
How about for you, Claire?
Well, note that going back to the topic of Congress just for a moment, remember that the Russians didn't just hack the DNC, but also the RNC. And that information, those emails have not been released and were not used in the way that the hack of the DNC was used. So we actually don't know what is out there in terms of information about GOP communications. So when you ask the question, why are the Republicans in Congress continuing to circle the wagons around this president, we don't know the full story yet. I think we will have, in terms of the future of this investigation, an attempt on the part of the White House to undercut the investigation in every way possible, including most likely firing Rod Rosenstein and then potentially leading to the firing of Robert Mueller. If that happens, I think not only would it be a terrible moment for the rule of law in this country, but it would also be a very poor strategic decision on the part of the White House, as of course happened with James Comey. But what happens from there is anyone's guess, because it may be complete chaos at that point.
I'm Marty Moscowen, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. Clint, let me ask you about how you see the mood at the FBI. And I ask that knowing that the president has certainly criticized the press over the last couple of years, but I would also argue that the press has been doing an extraordinary job just covering all these myriad issues that are out there and scandals and potential scandals. How do you see this playing out on the FBI?
I see a couple, I would say, forces or trends that will play out. I think on the one, inside the FBI, the agents and analysts are going to do their jobs as they've always done. You know, they're not really going to shut anything down. They're not going to think about it on a daily basis, and they'll move on and they'll continue to be professionals. A second thing that I think is bizarre is that after 9/11, the Republican Party, the GOP, was the one seen as the defender of the tools like FISA, the Patriot Act, as weapons, you know, we could use to investigate terrorists. And now you see the GOP undermining those exact tools that they once championed. And so I think that's a bit destabilizing for agencies like the FBI or CIA or even the Department of Defense to understand, like, what's the real motives behind all of this and who can we rely on? I think the third thing, and this is most damaging to the country writ large, is the institution will hesitate. Meaning that, imagine if you're an FBI agent today in a Trump, heavy part of America, and you're running a case, criminal or national security, and you are going out and trying to get informants or talk to witnesses, how much more difficult your job has just become. Or if you're doing a FISA application or a Title III application on a criminal wiretap for a public corruption case, and you have to talk about politicians that are maybe being targeted. Putting your name on that application, you don't know if when the application goes forward or 3 or 4 years from now, some politician is going to grab something, pull it out of context, and use it as a political weapon against an opponent or as a way to discredit you for doing your job as a government servant. So ultimately, there's the erosion of democratic institutions. And what's most shocking is, I thought this was going to come from Russia, you know, having watched this Russian influence stuff. But it's really just Americans taking those same techniques and using them on each other. So we have American active measures today, whereas 2 years ago I was studying Russian active measures. I'd never thought that Americans, politicians, and our elected leaders would take those techniques on that authoritarians have used.
Well, I hate to leave it there, but
the shocking part.
Yeah, I hear you. We have to leave it there. We could go on. Clint Watts, thank you for joining us on Radio Times.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Claire Finkelstein, thank you for joining us as well.
Thanks for
coming into
me,
our studios. And Quinta Jurecic, thank you for joining us.
Thanks so much.
You're very welcome. Go to WHYY.org/Radio Times to find out much more about the program. Adam Stanishevsky, the engineer for today's edition of the show, produced by Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Trinae Nuri. I'm Marty Moscowen. Thank you for joining us.